You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's show, we head to an often overlooked part of the world when it comes to the subject of cryptids, Asia and Oceania. Many will be aware of the more famous members of this area, the Yowie, the Tasmanian Tiger, and the Yeti, but there's many more waiting for their chance to appear in the limelight. Author Carol Scott's new book, Cryptids of Asia and Oceania, shines a light on some that barely cause a ripple, from the Batatut, the Ropan, Japan's twin lake monsters Issy and Kussy, and many more await us in the pages of Carol's new book. But before we head to faraway lands, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link to sign up in the show notes. A big thank you to Teresa, my latest patron, and thank you to everybody else who supports the show via Patreon. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters on all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, while it's here, Instagram, LinkedIn, Mastodon, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. Mysteries and Monsters is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and we are delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, let's join Carol Scott for a whistle-stop tour of Asia and Oceania on the hunt for some lesser-known cryptids. Joining me today is author and researcher Carol Scott to discuss her brilliant new book, The Cryptids of Asia and Oceania. People tend to focus on the more famous cryptid inhabitants of this particular area, the Yowie, the Tasmanian Tiger, the Moa and the Yeti. Yet there is a plethora of other lesser-known cryptids in this area which Carol's book shines a light upon. Carol, I am delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are you?
Good. Thank you, Paul, and thank you for that great introduction.
You are very welcome. Thank you for collecting such a wonderful book in regards to some of these lesser-known cryptids that, as I'm sure we'll dive into, deserve far more recognition than a lot of them. When I've heard you speak, Carol, and followed your work, I'm always interested to find out what gets people excited or interested in cryptozoology and monsters in general. And a lot of people, it might be a particular creature, or it might be a particular film, or even a personal experience. But I've heard you mention a program that often gets overlooked, and maybe that's because this is one of those programs that is inspiring the generation that's followed myself and others. I don't know. Carol, I'm not presuming anybody's age in this conversation. And that is Animal X, which I think is probably the most underrated cryptozoological show that's been on television in the last 20 years.
Yeah, it's definitely something, I happened to catch an episode literally at a life-changing moment. I was moving from Canada to the U.S. with my family, and we were in a hotel. We happened to stumble across it. I cannot recall the particular episode, but I was immediately hooked. And I was like, this is so cool. So I was pretty much immediately into cryptozoology from there. And my parents were really supportive of that. My mother is actually a librarian and researcher. So mm-hmm. She was always definitely encouraging the scientific method and, you know, really getting into how to research properly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually pretty formative in being able to look at a source of information and evaluate it and really see, you know, is it worth taking this person's writings as information?
Mm.
While my dad, he's actually always had an interest in cryptozoology. It was just, he didn't really have an outlet for it until I got into it. So he talks to cryptozoologists on Facebook all the time and now, and, you know, he just really enjoys finding out about, you know, all these different mysteries and what you can learn from the culture that surrounds them. Mm-hmm. And I think that also influenced the book a lot, is just looking at the culture of where this cryptid is reported to be. Yeah. And how does that really affect how they're portrayed? Is there, you know, is there a reason why they haven't gained more notoriety?
Mm-hmm.
And so on. So it was definitely Animal X was pretty life-changing. And yeah, it was always very enjoyable. And I actually, there was one time where the creators, or yeah, the stars were at the Fort Worth Zoo.
Yeah.
Which I lived nearby at the time. And I was actually sick that day, but a bunch of my friends went.
Oh, no.
So I definitely think maybe there is a generational thing there. Also, I know a lot of when I was in, I think it would have been middle school when Monster Quest was on.
Yeah.
On Disney Channel. And I know a lot of people were definitely into that one. So
yeah, Monster Quest was fabulous. I've been lucky enough to speak with Doug Highcheck about his show and his investigation council. Yeah, I adored that program. So I'll devour anything that's got a focus on cryptozoology regardless. So that's one of the joys of YouTube, is it allows us to go back and find some of these shows. Though Animal X is now on Prime here in the UK, so I'm not sure if it's anywhere else, but I've always been a big fan of that program. So from that chance encounter with that showing, that was there a particular monster that grabbed you straight away, Carol, that you sort of went, wow, this is amazing? I know, like you were saying about your dad's always been in it, and you've been a conduit for him to be able to channel his love of all things cryptids since you discovered your love for it. Was there a particular creature at the beginning that you got into, or were you just devouring everything at that point?
Definitely a lot of devouring of everything. I would read every Lauren Coleman book. I even would bring to school this huge On the Track of Unknown Animals and by Bernard Hubbleman's.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, you know, in fifth grade, and they're like, why are you reading a book that big that isn't Harry Potter? But definitely my focus, I wouldn't necessarily say my focus, but my favorite remains to this day the thylazine.
Mm.
I think there's so much wrapped up in the thylazine that is so interesting, just from, even if you didn't want to take it as a cryptid and say maybe there's a possibility of it surviving.
Yeah.
There's, you know, still so much surrounding it. The extinction, how it's affected Australia's conservation policies, the attempts to resurrect it through cloning and other biomechanical means. Like, that's also fascinating. And I also just really think they're cute.
Yeah.
So it's definitely something where I just enjoy learning more about them. Recently, there was colorized film of Benjamin, the last known thylazine in captivity.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the last known thylazine in captivity in general. I don't think, think anyone's doubting that. And seeing like the colorization and a bit more of the extended footage, like it was just really a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something I really enjoy. Of course, I do definitely hold out hope that they're still around and we don't have to resort to biological stuff to bring them back. But
yeah,
even that's definitely fascinating, although outside of my realm of knowledge.
Yes, very much so. I think I'm very similar with this. The thylacine is one of those creatures, I think, because for me, Carol, it's so close. Where we've got creatures in centuries past, like the dodo or the moa, where we definitely know they existed, but it's probably too far gone that there's any survive. Whereas the thing about the thylacine, and also the fact that Australia is so bloody big, is that I think because we know it's a fairly recent alleged extinction, that for a lot of us that love these kind of things, it's so close we can almost touch it. Do you know what I mean? And I think for a lot of us that love this particular subject and have a real interest in the investigators and the researchers all around the world who are looking after or looking into specific creatures, Thylacine, Benjamin especially, who is the poster boy for all of us that love these wonderful creatures, it's the fact that we know it's there. We've got film of it. And down to the stupidity of man, we've right. lost it, allegedly. But I am, if you were ever to put me on the spot, Carol, and said, right, what out of all the cryptids in the world do you think still exist? I would put my house on the Thylacine Thilbeen out there somewhere.
Right on.
I mean, because I've seen so many people out there, like I say, and Australia is so big that you've had some of the most famous crypto experts in the world who have done TV shows like Josh Gates and Forrest Gallant, who have gone looking for these creatures. And they meet these people who have clearly had an experience with something that isn't very similar to anything else that's running about in Australia or Tasmania, that it can only be a thylacine. There is nothing else it could be. And I think a lot of people seem to think it's one of those creatures where people know it exists, but they don't want to admit that it exists because it'll just create some kind of furore or whatever. But it's such a beautifully tantalizing thing that I think that's one of the key driving points to it for me, Carol.
Definitely, very much agree. I think it is kind of the what if we find it? You know, like that upends so much. Like, it's been a symbol of making sure creatures don't go extinct. So I guess you got to find a new poster child for that. And just being able to see these magnificent creatures again would just be incredible. And I guess also from, I guess, like a political side, good luck to the Australian government who has to, talk to loggers down in Tasmania and go, actually, don't go anywhere near that anymore. You know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are, many people when it comes to specific cryptids, Carol, will often say that that's one of the reasons they don't want to admit they're there, because it could cause some industries a few headaches, to say the least.
Definitely.
So, obviously, it's quite surprising to see a book about the cryptids of Asia and Oceania, Carol, because as we say, and as I said in my introduction, most people who have an interest in this subject will know of the Yeti and the Yowie and the Thylacine, and to some extent the Moa, though as often people get a bit, some people get really put out when we talk about things like the Thylacine or the Moa being cryptids, because they're real creatures. We know they existed. We've got skeletons. We've got footage. We know they were real. Whereas for some people, it seems that cryptids can only be creatures that we've yet to fully prove existed. Whereas I'm of the mindset that cryptids cover all kinds of creatures, both living and extinct, or not proven as yet.
Exactly. And I think when I was devouring all those books as a kid, I guess I got into my head that there's three types of cryptids. There's the ones that have yet to be discovered. So that would be your Bigfoot, your Yowie, your Loch Ness Monster. Then you have the presumed extinct, but there's reports. And, that would be the Thylacine, the Moa, etc. And then you have alien big cats, which aren't actual aliens. They're just not where they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always how I divided them in my head. And doesn't actually, just as a note, alien big cats don't necessarily only include cats. I think it was Texas maybe about a decade ago where there was ghost kangaroo sightings, which are maybe escaped from a zoo or what have you. I didn't particularly look into it. I just happened to live in Texas at the time, so I heard a lot about it.
Well, obviously, Lauren Coleman covered that in Mysterious America. And
yes, that's true.
I recently spoke with David Weatherly about his Monsters of the Beehive State covering Utah. And there's a section in there about these phantom kangaroos, Carol. I've always found these reports from around the US about kangaroos just appearing from the middle out of nowhere is quite amusing more than anything.
Yeah, I think if I happen to be driving around the United States and a kangaroo just passed me by, I don't even know how I'd process it. I think I would just laugh. Like, wow, you're really not where you're supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, like we were saying at the time, the only state that wouldn't surprise me, Carol, is Florida, because what doesn't live in Florida, I don't think exists, to be honest.
Exactly.
These days. So for you, was it the thylacine that kind of drew you to this area of the world and looking into some of the other creatures around it? Because diving into this particular part of the world to cover cryptids for a book is quite unusual, Carol. These are usually specialized subjects that certain researchers have covered. Some of these creatures, like I say, the thylacine. Neil Waters is probably the most famous researcher out there in Australia at the minute, who's done a lot of work in trying to finally capture proof of it. But there are other creatures. A friend of mine has just recently returned from Sumatra looking for the Orang Pendek, and I'll be speaking to him about the evidence that they've uncovered. And I'm looking very much to speaking with him, because I think he's got something very surprising to tell me, I hope. And then you've got other ones, such as the research that's gone on in China in regards to the Yeren and things. So was the thylacine your sort of entrance into this part of the world, Carol? Or were you just, as you devoured these subjects, you thought, well, why doesn't anybody sort of look at these creatures more?
It was actually definitely the latter. Just seeing, I know there's a book called Cryptozoology A to Z by, I believe, George Eber, I believe it's his name.
Yeah.
And it's great book, you know, a huge encyclopedia of every cryptid you could probably ever think of.
Mm-hmm.
But it is striking to note that, you know, ones from Asia and Oceania and also Africa, which isn't included in this book, but definitely has a lot of the same issues. You know, they were just covered less. They were less thorough, and there aren't a lot of expeditions to go find information about these creatures, not even necessarily expeditions to find footprints or other evidence, just in general to find information. And, you know, it's just quite interesting. And that's kind of what I wanted to look at, is why does this happen? And basically provide a baseline for further research. You know, if someone is particularly, you know, like they read the Queensland Tiger chapter and they're like, okay, I want to look more into that, and they write a whole book about that. And, you know, you could definitely do more than I did. I did try to get as much information as possible,
mm-hmm.
but being able to go to that place, talk to people there, is invaluable. And for certain creatures, definitely getting to talk to people who live there, get knowledge that is older than the current generation, and all that. And one of the things that came up more than once was archival material being destroyed or not well cared for. There's actually a funny bit in the Getty chapter, is actually that there was, I believe it was a hand, and it was actually stolen by researchers. And I believe it was the actor Jimmy Stewart who helped them get it out.
Yeah, it was.
It was like, huh? But, you know, even on a less amusing note, in Sri Lanka, that I'm always going to butcher the pronunciation of this, the Netawo, who I would talk to a researcher who lives in Sri Lanka, and apparently the original copies of text about these creatures is basically falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
There's no digital version. I don't believe there's been any copy made, physical, digital, or otherwise.
Yes.
So it, you know, and that's actually from a Western researcher who was there. So it's not even just, oh, we don't respect the indigenous people of Sri Lanka. We don't care about archiving this at all.
Yeah.
And obviously that's our history. Like as a, you know, as a species, is just our memories, our reports. And even if one wanted to not be generous and say all of the cryptids in here are folklore, that's still important to humanity. Obviously not from like a scientific perspective where we can go, okay, looking back at this report, here's what we can tell about this creature. Just being able to get to know the indigenous people of Sri Lanka or any other people from any particular country and how they worked, how they live, what they thought about the world around them.
Mm.
And that's definitely something that I found quite sad.
Yeah. I think it is. For me, things like this are very important, regardless of your body of work, Carol, and the work you've done. I think it shines a light on the fact that sometimes culturally we just don't value our past very much.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of us in the modern era, more of us are looking backwards and trying to preserve what's gone before rather than try and improve it or ignore it or just push it away because we don't believe it to be important. But I think the older we get, the more we know, the more respect and understanding we have of our past. And regardless of where you are in the world and where you've come from, I think these things are vitally important. And it's a real shame when you hear that certain cultures or certain countries, there doesn't seem to be people out there who are doing this. And often people will say, well, maybe this is just some kind of tourist obsession that people from the US or Canada or Britain or Australia or whatever will go around the world on a monster hunt, whereas everybody else is either not bothered or, as far as they're concerned, they're just normal creatures to them, which is obviously something that comes up quite a lot in certain countries in Asia, that the locals just don't raise their eyes to them because, as far as they're concerned, they're just part of the normal fauna of the area, and it's only us that go, oh, blimey, this is a bit strange. So it's interesting when you mention that, what's going on in Sri Lanka, because it makes you wonder, because how many other countries have got this rich history? Because obviously, that, as you were saying about your pronunciation, and I'll probably do the same, the Netowo, when I'm reading about these, and I've only heard of them briefly in other bits and bats over the years, they really do remind me of what's happened with the home of Florence, which is something that was completely dismissed out of hand for decades by researchers and anthropologists and scientists, that there was no such thing as these smaller people that were living around the world. And now here we are in the 21st century. We know that there were little people that lived in communities and had a civilization. So if that's happened in that particular region, why can't it happen in somewhere else? Yes, I know Sri Lanka's quite far throwaway from where the Homo Florensis has been discovered, but it's still geographically in the same location. It's a big expanse, though. So why can't they have had this situation? And also the fact that there seems to be this kind of very similar history to the fact that the locals, there was some kind of genocide, wasn't there?
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah, it was quite interesting to read. Essentially, the locals were quite a bit annoyed with the Netowo and basically lured them into a cave and set a fire at the opening of the cave, and all the creatures suffocated to death, which is just horrible to think about. It's also one of my focuses when I was actually getting my undergraduate degree was genocide studies. That was something that definitely was quite interesting to read, kind of a mix and match of various interests of mine. And, you know, it was just kind of unbelievable that I had never come across this before, whether in cryptozoology circles and, you know, historical depictions of genocide. And yeah, there's just in general a very, very lacking in terms of research.
Mm. I find that aspect of it as well really quite peculiar, because obviously there is a very famous similar story from the US, which is Mammoth Cave, I think,
mm-hmm.
where the local tribe had a conflict with a race of Bigfoot who were also living in a cave, and they set fire to it, and then the same thing happened there. That, for me, is remarkable, because there is no way that either of these peoples would have had any contact. So there's no way either of these people would have told each other the story, Carol, because
right.
Obviously you've got a tribe in America and a population living in Sri Lanka half the world away. And yet they both have, obviously the main difference is the size of these creatures. However, there is this conflict and this solution to their problems, which both involve setting fire to them in caves, which is one of those weird things that sometimes pops up when we talk about cryptozoology around the world.
And another thing to add on to the differences between the North American report and the Netowo was the genocide of the Netowo. That's estimated to take place in very early 1800s.
Mm.
I believe Mammoth Cave was 1600s.
Something like that, yeah.
So very much a vastly different time period. And obviously there is some interconnectedness in the world even back then, but that's quite a leap to say this small tribe in Sri Lanka that didn't receive many visitors was, you know, as soon as they get one visitor, they're like, hey, we're going to tell you this story that we got from South America, but we're going to make it about us.
Yes.
You know, it's just so many leaps in logic if you wanted to go down that route.
Yeah. I'm sure somebody out there is desperately clutching at that straw, Carol, somewhere. But the other thing leading on from that that's always surprised me about, well, not surprised me, it intrigued me more than anything, is that it seems wherever we go in this particular area, there are hairy bipeds all over the place. You've got them in China, which is the Yeren, obviously. Mongolia's got the Almas. We've got the Yeti wandering around the Himalayas. You've got the Hibigon in Japan, the Batutut in Vietnam, and that kind of area of Asia. When you were diving into this, were you surprised how regularly these hairy creatures would keep popping up on different parts of the Asian peninsula and into Oceania, Carol? Because I think, once again, when people talk about hairy bipeds, they will think of Bigfoot and Sasquatch, Yowie, Yeti, and they just don't think that there are any reports anywhere else in the world. And yet, as your book easily shows, well, that's nonsense because they're all over the place in Asia.
Exactly. An earlier version of the book was actually dividing the creatures instead of by their location, by their type. So I actually put unknown primates in their own section. It was, I think, the second largest section on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, there's just a ton. I had heard of some of them, obviously, Yeti, Yowie, but even stuff, you know, like the Almas, the Hibigon, that was new to me.
Mm.
I had vaguely heard of Japanese Bigfoot, just never actually looked into it.
Yeah.
But that was quite interesting. I find the Hibigon really fascinating because it basically peaked during the same time as the fascination with Sasquatch in North America.
Mm.
And it almost seemed like the people in that town were seeing reports of Bigfoot and going, we should get one of those. I don't really want to make a claim either way. Obviously, I've never talked to a person there, so I don't want to make claims about that. It was just the timing was very interesting.
Mm.
And also, there was a lot of very interesting theories. One of them, I found this in a book that was published in, I think, the 80s. It was like, oh, the Hibigon is actually a survivor of the nuclear bomb.
Yeah, because they're near Hiroshima, aren't they?
Who had just been living around the area, and they started seeing it. And I was like, oh. I feel like whoever came up with that, their only knowledge of Japan was that it had a nuclear bomb drop on it.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't find any actual Japanese researcher going, yeah, this might be a possibility.
Mm, yeah.
So overall, that was just very, very interesting. They actually called it Hibigon fever.
Yeah.
They said it was so sudden and the town was pretty much unprepared for it. Another thing that was quite funny about that particular case was that the town actually created a job for the dealing with all the issues related to the Hibigon. Okay. The person had previously only like managed taxes in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And also they would pay resident who spotted the creature for the inconvenience of seeing him in it. There's, you know, it's just quite interesting. Especially if you imagine like somewhere in Texas, there's a Bigfoot sighting and the local town is like, okay, well, we gotta get Dave from down at the post office. We've got to get him on this. And we're gonna start paying out everyone who sees it.
I mean, whenever I see anything about cryptids in Japan, I'm always really surprised that there aren't more resources or books on this particular subject, because the Japanese seem to have a real thirst for cryptids. They've sent teams to Loch Ness. I know when I spoke to Tony Healy, I did an episode about the cryptids of New Zealand a couple of years ago, Carol. And we were talking about a very amusing expedition that a Japanese scientific team had done, where they'd gone looking for the moa in New Zealand, and they'd taken recordings of it to try and attract it. And we were both kind of wondering how they knew what the moa sounded like, because obviously it's been extinct for 300 years. So yes. Were they using ostrich calls, or were they using some other emus or something like that? We weren't really sure how they were trying to attract it in, but it seems as though they're very interested in other people's cryptids and not their own. And when you've got, because obviously they've got two very famous lake monsters there as well, which are Issy and Cussy. For me, out of the two, I think there's more to Issy than Cussy, but I mean, both of them live in volcanic calderas that have a tendency to freeze over in the winter, which is also one of those problematic issues we get with lake monsters, Carol. Well, if it freezes over, then surely they can't breathe air.
Exactly.
Unless they're like salamanders and breathe through their skin. But so I'm always surprised when I see so little about Japan's creatures. Was that something you were aware of, or was it something that you also thought that, because Japan seems to be a country that loves anything a bit out there in general culturally, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. I wasn't overly familiar with any of the Japanese cryptids. So, and especially trying to dive in and research them, very lacking in any English sources. So pretty frequently I was trying to translate Japanese websites, and I do not speak Japanese. I do not know anyone who speaks Japanese. So that was a lot of Google Translate and hoping that it came out decent.
Yeah.
So there's no direct quote from any of those Japanese sources. I don't want to quote them on something if it came from Google Translate. But even then, I don't know if it was the problem of I'm using English to search or what have you. But even then, there was definitely a lack of just overall discussion. Not even, you know, sometimes newspapers or such from older time frames don't get archived or what have you. I'm not really sure how Japan feels, how much is dedicated to preserving that kind of stuff. But even, you know, going on Japanese forums and, you know, they would be discussing Sasquatch or, you know, anything that isn't from Japan.
Yeah.
And it was like, I mean, everyone's going to be interested in something different, but it was just, I don't think I found really a single Japanese person on the internet who is interested in cryptozoology, who also is particularly interested in Japanese cryptids.
It is problematic. I mean, obviously, when I dive into these things, and I get let my YouTube run wild, Carol, it'll just start auto-playing things. And strangely enough, the other week, even before I had arranged to speak with yourself, something came up about Issy on my YouTube, and the person who'd done it clearly didn't know anything about Japan, because they said Issy was seen on an island off the coast of Japan. So I don't think that person knows that Japan's made of four islands. So I think they just thought Japan is one of them. And not all parts of Japan are connected to the main island, or the largest one anyway. So it was a bit, even when people stumble across it, I think, as you say there, it's a question of who's got the knowledge and how they present it, because then that starts a misinformation campaign through no fault of their own, perhaps, but often somebody can find something out and they will, as you've said, you've avoided using Google Translate because, with the greatest respect, yes, it's very good, but it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. So you, when you're dealing with a language that I'm exactly the same as you, Carol, I know next to nothing about the Japanese language other than certain specific terms, and my love of Godzilla is the only sort of inroad I've got into that kind of language. So other than that, you would be really sort of pushing the boat out to try and get some clarity, especially when you were coming up against the fact, as you refer to there, they were more interested in Sasquatch than Issy.
Yeah, it's definitely very interesting. And, you know, like there, I'm not sure if this was a problem of the English sources. You know, as you stated, sometimes videos and other sources don't necessarily know everything about Japan. But there was, for both Issy and Cussy, there was weird discrepancies that were overall minor things, but they kind of bring the whole thing into where are the good sources on this?
Yeah.
Even something like isi. So in Japan, they commonly use the honorific kun for it, which is masculine.
Yes.
But isi in folklore is female.
Yeah.
So obviously that's not a huge deal, but it is kind of one of those things that makes you think, okay, what else is wrong with this picture?
Yes. Well, it's the same here, Carol. Everybody, when you talk to, well, not everybody, when you talk to a lot of people about Nessie, they'll call her or she, but they've not, how do we know this? We don't know if it's a female. Obviously, you would expect that there will be females, otherwise there wouldn't be any Nessie, clearly. So, but it's weird how certain creatures seem to develop a sexuality, even though we've no idea. And so lake monsters tend to be, especially outside of the US and Canada, they tend to be female for some reason, like you say, with Issy and Cussy and Nessie. So whether it's because their names end in C, I don't know. But the Japanese one, just like you say, it throws me that because it's female male. And I'm thinking, well, how does that work?
Exactly. And I did reach out to some Japanese researchers. I'm not sure if they ever saw my emails, but, you know, just was like, hey, just looking to research this, would appreciate any help, or even just trying to figure out the situation with the honorific.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not a major thing. It's just a very weird discrepancy.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised how often that came up in the book, was just someone says, here is this fact. And then you look at the second source and it says, here's a contradictory fact. They both have like the same level of trustworthiness. So it's not like you can necessarily say, oh, this person's more likely to be correct.
Yeah.
So it's just a lot of the research was, I would have so many tabs open just seeing, and then a book open on my desk and trying to figure out, okay, what's the truth that I can figure out? Again, with the honorific, I just kind of made the note of it in the footnotes. And I'm like, well, if anyone wants to study that further, be my guest. Here's what I got. Good luck in your search.
In regards to, as we were touching on, the thylacine, one of the other theories that often gets put forward these days and seems to be getting a lot more traction, Carol, is the fact that people are saying, well, even if the thylacine is extinct in the Australian mainland and Tasmania, if it's going to be anywhere, we reckon its cousin, the Dobergan, is in Papua New Guinea, I think. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are of the mindset now, it seems, that Papua New Guinea is going to be a really good place to find the thylacine. Because I think they're not the same, but they are sort of cousins, aren't they?
Definitely very similar. And so there is, of note, the thylacine was at one point part of New Guinea's wildlife.
Mm.
I believe they were, from the fossil record, we know they were there about 11,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, things do disappear in certain areas for no particular reason.
Mm.
But, you know, there is evidence that it could live there. That's definitely something that interests people. And of course, 11,000 years, probably some changes have been made just through evolution on the creature. So it's not exactly a thylacine.
Mm.
But yeah, we do have reports of, I believe the most recent was actually in the 1990s. But again, you know, Papua New Guinea is not very much a hub for researchers.
Mm.
So, and again, language barriers and such, there could be sightings every day that just no one's recording them.
Sure.
And yeah, I definitely do think it's possible. And I do believe that there was a cattle farmer who actually was so struck by reports of this very similar creature to the thylacine. He traveled and visited with a local population that doesn't speak with the quote unquote modern world very often.
Yep.
And he showed them pictures of the thylacine and they were like, oh yeah, that's the Dobsegna. And it's like, oh, interesting.
Mm.
So that's definitely something where I think more research could be done in that regard. Again, there is obviously the issue of funding for expeditions to this area.
Yeah.
Asia and Oceania in general, obviously a lot of cryptozoologists live in North America or Europe, and flights to these areas aren't necessarily cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to deal with getting some transportation around the country, the area, maybe finding a translator depending on the country's language and your own knowledge of it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's one of the biggest barriers to studying most of these cryptids. Obviously, Australia, you don't have necessarily the language issue, but you do still have the costs, the time commitment, and that's not even getting into like housing and food, of course.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a reason I didn't travel to every one of these countries for the book as much as I think that would be very interesting. I think that's why a lot of the time there tends to be focus on, Sasquatch, Loch Ness Monster, et cetera, is that they're very accessible, almost in your backyard, depending on where you are.
Yeah.
When I lived in Texas, there was the Texas Bigfoot Research Center, and, they would go on pretty frequent expeditions.
Mm.
And it would just be an hour or two away. Like, that's not much of a drive, especially in Texas where, you have to drive basically an hour or two to get anywhere.
Yes.
And, or if you're in Europe, it's pretty easy to get to Loch Ness, study that.
Mm.
And versus all of these cryptids where they're very inaccessible unless you're backed by funding. So someone like Josh Gates, he comes up a couple of times in the book just because he's one of the few people who has gone to these areas and been able to research them.
Yeah.
And obviously he has funding behind him. It makes money. So as opposed to someone who goes to China or what have you to study something, and maybe they don't necessarily come back with something that you can make money off of.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Josh Gates is a very interesting, as you mentioned, I know he turns up a couple of times in the book because obviously Josh had a very, I would say, a life-changing experience when he went looking for the Yeti, because he found footprints and that just seemed to blow his mind at the time, Carol. I don't think he thought there was that much in it until he found something. And then that really seemed to fire him up to the point that he had, because I think he went when he did, was it Destination Truth, his first series? Yes. Where he was looking for cryptids, because I know he touched, as we mentioned earlier, the Batatut, because he found something with that as well. And then he went back with his Destination Unknown for the Yeti and did a big sort of massive expedition with a guy from over here who lives in America now, Adam Davis. And that, once again, going back to Japanese researchers, featured that footage that a Japanese Yeti team had uncovered, which clearly shows some hairy creature wandering around a mountain from 8,000 feet up in the air. So it's clearly, as often is put forward, Carol, it's not somebody wandering about in a fur coat taking the Michael. So the thing about that is he obviously was so enthused by what he found in regards to the Yeti they went back. But with the Batatut, they found footprints, they took casts. I think Dr. Jeff Meldrum examined them, said they were really interesting, fantastic. And then nothing seems to have happened after that.
Yeah, that tends to happen quite a bit. Even just going into footprints are obviously great. I'm not discounting them.
Mm-hmm.
But there was one of the New Zealand cryptids that I'm having a hard time recalling now. They I believe a British museum, they found the preserved body. We're like, hey, this is actually something we've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lost it. And it's like you couldn't put any more effort into making sure that this new species that you found in the archives wasn't lost. And that happens quite a bit. It's just lost evidence, anywhere from, obviously Josh Gates didn't lose his footprints, but they just kind of go away. Nothing ever gets done. And it's like, well, maybe who knows what happened with the footprints, but, stuff like the the Yeti scalp and such that have disappeared, the body of that lizard that I mentioned.
Yeah.
It's just like, everyone could do better in these situations, I think.
Well, I often chuckle when you'll hear a story breaking that somebody's discovered some kind of dinosaur that's been put in a drawer in a museum somewhere, Carol. That seems to happen quite a lot. Or it's been misclassified 50 years ago, and then they've just done a checking of the archives and they've gone, hang on a minute, this isn't, and then they go, Anadon, this is a whole new species of dinosaur. So even in the hands of experts, things get mislabeled or misfiled, shall we say? So it's one of those tantalizing things that for all we know, in a box somewhere, in some museum or some location around the world, there could be some wonderful evidence that proves one of these creatures is real, but it's just been misfiled or it's still waiting to be archived.
Right. And I believe the Smithsonian, basically their entire archive is at least twice the size of everything that's actually on display.
Yeah.
And just because of funding or maybe to some extent, they just don't want to go through all of it. You just have all that stuff sitting down there in the archives. And, you know, that goes for stuff like the British Museum, the Museum of Natural History. And it's definitely a loss, not even just in terms of cryptozoology, but scientific knowledge, historical knowledge. You know, it's just like you can't get some college students down there, you know, give them free food and have them archive stuff. I'd go for that personally. That sounds cool.
Well, yeah, it sounds like a fabulous way to waste some time, in my opinion, as well, Carol. I completely agree with you. I was delighted to see as well another country that doesn't seem to get much credit or much of a light shone on it in regards to its strange creatures is India. I think often people tend to focus on a couple of crazy cases. I know you mentioned the man monkey is in your book, and a lot of people have kind of dismissed that as mass hysteria, like some other famous cases like Spring-Heeled Jack and the Mad Gasser of Mattoon and things like that. But I've always been interested in there because obviously the northern edge of India butts up against the Himalayas. And so there seems to be a bit of confusion when it comes to this part of India, that there are sightings of a hairy creature there called the Mande Barung, which some people say, oh, well, they're seeing the Yeti. But when you speak to the people who live there, they say, no, it's the Mande Barung. It's different.
Right, exactly. And I think that also goes into Western biases to kind of, you know, everything's just kind of a mix over there. So when reports in northeastern India are saying, oh, we have a Sasquatch creature that's nothing like the Yeti, but it's right next to Nepal.
Yep.
Oh, that's the Yeti.
Mm.
So there definitely is, you know, that factor in addition to you just have very few people in general studying these. So it's easier to just say, you know, if you're writing an article on the Yeti, just to say, oh yeah, northeastern India has some stuff too.
Yeah.
Versus actually letting the, you know, the people who have seen the creature speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I think as well, the thing that's always tantalized me about this particular creature is that it's got one of the best witnessed encounters ever, because I think 15 people saw one of them about 20 years ago. So a guy called, was it James McCann?
Yes.
James Merak, sorry, that's his name, yeah.
Yeah, so he's a forestry officer, and I believe the 14 other people were also officials working on a tiger census.
Mm.
And, you know, they just saw something that, you know, they know the area.
Yeah.
So it was like, oh, yeah, that's not supposed to be here.
Yeah, and I know Richard Freeman's, I think he's done an expedition up there as well, and he found some intriguing evidence as well. So it's, I think it's like you say, it's one of those things. I mean, what always gets my goat is when people talk about creatures in Russia and they always call them Yetis. And I'm like, why are you calling that? It's almost as if anything from that part of the world gets called a Yeti, Carol, for some reason. And maybe it's late. It's often like when you see a lake monster, they'll go, it's such and such's version of Nessie.
Even if there's not a lot of similarities in the reports, besides that they're in a lake.
But yeah.
That's something that actually comes up with Issy and Kussy in Japan.
Yeah.
Kussy is said to be more eel-like But, you know, they're just, there are depictions of it as a plesiosaur type creature, because the idea of a lake monster is, oh, this is Nessie.
Yeah, yeah. It always frustrates me when they try and describe Champ or Ogopogo as versions of Nessie, and yet both Ogopogo and Champ, there's far more evidence for both of those, and the story and the reports are, you know, we've got 200 to 300 years worth of people saying they've seen things in these particular bodies of water, whereas Nessie is fairly recent in the whole scheme of things. I'm sure if we really dip down into it, I'm sure there'll be a few people that would have seen something strange going on in Loch Ness, but it's also really modern compared to those two. And so surely Nessie is Scotland's version of Champ, is it not?
True.
So is there any other particular creature that you were either surprised to discover, or you've discovered a new love for that's in this region, or one? Because I have to say, I thought you skillfully danced around the problematic creature of the ropen, which which is one of those which is a real issue, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely, it's definitely very interesting to look at something like the ropen, which actually does get studied a lot more than other creatures in this book. Not necessarily because there's more evidence or anything like that. It's just there's a particular group that is invested enough in proving that this creature is real, that they're willing to fund it.
Yeah.
And again, you know, that goes back into being able to actually go to these locations to interview people, to get the technology to study these, where young Earth creationists, they'd be willing to say, oh, there's dinosaurs still living here right now. So revise your timeline, scientists, you know. I mean, I guess if you have the money to spare, I can't really make fun of you for going after something you believe in.
Yeah.
But it is, I guess I would say, rather sad when there's other creatures that I think deserve more attention. I guess going back to the Netawo, you know, I don't think they still exist. There was like one report in, I think, the 1980s.
Yeah.
But that's it, basically. Mm-hmm. Everything after 1800s is just that one person. But I think there's still a lot that can be done there on the research front. And again, because of the lack of digital archives of material, you know, there's obviously going to Sri Lanka would be a great benefit, but that's just not something that everyone's going to be able to put up the money for.
Yeah.
And if you do have the money, why not go for the Ooring Pendek, something that there's also a lot of evidence for and maybe still exists. Well, presumably it's still alive, you know, that's what I meant. And versus creatures that are kind of just, I don't want to say like someone's pet project.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's definitely that factor. That also comes up a lot in African cryptids, I've noticed. They have multiple dinosaur type cryptids, and a lot of those are also pretty heavily focused on by young Earth creationists. So that's also another thing where, because at one point I was thinking about including Africa, but it kind of ran into the same problem where, you know, there's just not a lot of research done on any of these cryptids except for the Mokila Mbembe. And I'm forgetting the name, but there's another one that I think, I don't know, it has like a horror thing.
Yeah.
I remember about it. And, you know, it's definitely something where you want to go there and actually talk to people, look through archives if there are any. But if you're a researcher who wants to prove that these creatures exist, you might, you know, go for the high ticket items.
Yeah.
You know, Mokila Mbembe, Yeti, Ooring Pendek, Thylazine. Like those are the ones that it's a lot easier to get funding for. It's a lot easier to convince not just other people, but also yourself.
Yeah.
That this is a worthwhile endeavor. And, you know, if you're a young Earth creationist, why would you care about any other African cryptid except for the Mokila Mbembe, the one that would prove your point, you know?
Yeah.
So you're going to put all your money on that, regardless of evidence that you really, you know, evidence of whatever exists there.
I have to say, when I stumbled across that and the theories behind, as you say, the rope and Mokila Mbembe, I found it extremely eye-opening, because I was not aware that that was even a thing. And it also made me chuckle because it proves that some people have a very loose understanding of evolution. Just because a dinosaur exists doesn't mean everything else is wrong. So it's...
Exactly.
Like birds.
But yeah, definitely is something that kind of has to be contended with. It's, you know, like there's got to be people who are willing to fund going to try and find the rope in.
Yeah.
But maybe wouldn't, you know, put up the money for the Kalana, which is cryptid species of elephant in India.
Yeah.
Like it's just, it doesn't prove anything. It's not incredibly interesting to the general person, you know, so.
Yeah. And I think also the problem they've got with the roping is the roping means bird. So I'm not really sure ignoring things that disprove what the evidence you're trying to prove helps the case in that aspect, Carol, because I know a lot of different roping essentially means big bird in a lot of that particular area. And I know some people are saying that they may think it's two or three different types of bird that people are actually seeing. I mean, this bioluminescence thing that seems to have popped up has disappeared again. Nobody seems to be talking about the fact that they glow in the sky for some reason, thankfully. So I know, as you mentioned earlier, you were saying about any of these particular countries or creatures that you've covered in the book might inspire somebody to focus on a particular cryptid and chase them down and create a body of work based on one particular one. Is there any of these creatures in your collection that you've thought, as you touched on your love of the thylacine earlier, is there any of them that you think you really want to know a lot more about and you want to try and discover as much as you can on top of what you've actually written in this collection, Carol?
Yeah, so as far as the thylacine goes, I don't think I would ever do a work on it myself. There's definitely already a lot of researchers working on that, and they're all doing a great job. I know, you know, several people have filed, I don't think they're called requests for information in Australia, but petitioning the government to get the records of every thylacine sighting out.
Yeah.
Like that's great work. And I don't really know what angle I would come at to, you know, really shift the game, I guess.
Mm.
I have been considering doing a full work on the Netawo. I think there's just a lot there. And like I said, I don't think that they still exist anymore, but I think their story deserves to be told. There is also the interesting point that maybe, you know, I kind of opened the chapter with this, but obviously this is a book on cryptozoology, so it focuses on animals, but it, you know, we don't have the Netawo around to speak for themselves or however they would talk.
Yep.
So they could have been a, you know, a remnant population of Neanderthals for all we know, like very close to us. Not that killing every animal you see is good, but genocide of people is, you know, something obviously most humans look down upon. And, you know, I really just think being able to, you know, really go in depth and on their story, every theory, definitely getting some archival work done. Like when I was talking to the one researcher and he said that the original documents are basically falling apart.
Yeah.
Like that just broke my heart.
Mm-hmm.
That's invaluable. You can't put a price on that.
No.
Yeah, and I'm not necessarily sure why it hasn't been archived currently. You know, it might be maybe the place where it's held doesn't have the funds to archive it, or maybe no one's just had the interest to do so.
Mm.
But either way, we lose that copy. That's gone forever.
Yeah.
You'll only have the secondhand sources of the researcher who's read it and then told me what he found in it. And then it's just a very long list of getting away from the original work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's things like that that need to be preserved and researched, because we only have to look at, I know this week they've announced, I think they've been doing some kind of expedition and archaeology down in South America, Carol, and they've discovered traces of Denisovans down there, which is another one of these strange strands of human evolution that's only, once again, has only really appeared over the last 20 years, and we thought that they were in Europe. Now we found evidence that they got to South America, and now you're thinking, hang on a minute, what on earth is going on here? Because that is something that 30 years ago, nobody got any idea about. So when you're talking about some of the history that you are really interested in and what's got you fired up, then that just proves to me just how important it is to focus on these things and preserve them and investigate them, because you never know what we could discover.
Exactly. I won't say like the Netawo is like the missing link or something, but that's still vital to know the world's history, our history from an evolutionary standpoint, and just the history of Sri Lanka.
Yep.
And again, the Netawo story deserves to be told, because what happened to them was awful.
Yeah.
You know, in general, just being able to say, this was a bad thing that happened and let's not repeat it.
Mm.
That's still valuable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. Well, Carol, it's a fantastic collection and I congratulate you on pulling some of these wonderful creatures together and dragging them out into the real world for the rest of us to discover or read even more about or just indulge ourselves, because one of the things I like about this book is that each chapter and each country seems to be quite individual, so you can just dive into a particular region if you wish to and not bother with it, but I would suggest that you should read it all. So where can everybody get a copy of the book and follow your work online?
Yes, so the book, it can definitely be found on Amazon, whether that's .com, .ca. I'm not sure what the URL for the UK and Europe would be, but should be on those sites as well. You can get it digitally or in print. And not to toot my own horn, but the physical copy does look very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't keep a website or social media really, but Beyond the Fray, who is the publisher, they are definitely great to work with. So definitely check out their website and anything that they're publishing besides my book. And if you ever need to get in contact with me, definitely can go through them. Shannon's great. And yeah, I mean, I just really hope people enjoy the book. And, you know, if it inspires even one person to go, oh, this cryptid is so interesting, I'm going to study it more. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a win in my book.
Fantastic. Well, I recommend it. Anybody who's got an interest in cryptozoology or loves cryptids needs to have this book, primarily because I think it's one of the few books released in the modern era that covers creatures that don't normally get a look in. So congratulations, Carol. I think it's a wonderful body of work, and good luck to you. And I really look forward to your next project. I hope you will continue to look into some of these lesser known cryptids for all our enjoyment. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.